what their reasons were, what their intentions were, and we can hypothesize. We can't know for sure. It seems to me likely that at the very least that they were selecting this term because the other term was already taken. Whether in one could see that in a couple of different ways, though. You could either see it as in a kind of competitive sense. In other words, we are a rival group, and we're going to take a different name as a way of establishing our brand and as over against the synagogue. But there's a whole, there's a different way of interpreting it, which would be more the one I would be inclined to take, which is to see it as simply a recognition that what the ecclesia was something that was different, even somewhat different in kind from synagogue. That if they could have simply chosen to use the term synagogue as their own and presented themselves thereby as the true synagogue, as the rival, the one to the existing synagogue. And it's interesting that the one place where it really is somewhat used to refer to ecclesia is the letter of James. The letter of James does use the term synagogue more as an equivalent to the term ecclesia. I think it's very possible, if not likely, that the selection of the term ecclesia comes in the context of many of these Jewish disciples of Jesus who are also already participating in the synagogue. I mean, Paul, the picture we get of Paul in the book of Acts is as long as he is able to do so, he continues to be part of the synagogue community. And that they recognized that there was something different, that it was that what they were doing when they were gathering together with Jews and Gentiles in the Messiah, that it was something that was connected to what was going on in the synagogue, but something which was also had a distinct, there was something also new that was going on there. And so I think that having the different term, which was also a biblical term, could have been a way of capturing the sense of being of something distinct that would especially be helpful for someone who was participating in both. So, okay. That's actually a good introduction to the discussion of ecclesiology. And in particular, Israel ecclesiology. And what I want to do now is to draw out some of the implications of the kind of Israel Christology that I was presenting in the first presentation for this understanding of Israel ecclesiology. Now, of course, there's a certain type of Israel ecclesiology that corresponds to the type of Israel Christology that someone like N.T. Wright would espouse. That type of Israel ecclesiology actually has much in common with simply the historical Christian tradition of supersessionism. Namely, the church is Israel. The church is the true Israel, veros Israel. And that's obviously not the Israel ecclesiology that I'm setting forth here. I'm trying to present a type of Israel ecclesiology that corresponds to this broader Israel Christology, one which captures both the sense of Jesus' presence in and commitment to the ecclesia, and also conveys his presence and commitment to the Jewish people as a whole. Now, I think it's. I thought it might be worthwhile to start with a quote from Pope John Paul II. He said this: when one encounters Jesus, one encounters Judaism. When one encounters Jesus, one encounters Judaism. And by Judaism, he didn't just mean Jewish religion abstracted from the Jewish people. Judaism here is a term that captures both the sense of the Jewish people as this concrete people in time, in space, in history, and the way of life of the Jewish people in covenant, in relationship with God. Now, I think this is a very important statement. When one encounters Jesus, one encounters Judaism. And it's worth then asking a question based on that statement, if one were to accept that statement, which of course I do. If one does not encounter Judaism when one is apparently encountering Jesus, has one truly encountered Jesus?
That's an interesting question.
If one has not encountered Judaism, have you truly encountered Jesus if encountering Jesus means encountering Judaism? This, I think, is a question that's a very challenging one. A very challenging one, and should be a very challenging one, for Christians. And one which raises questions about the identity of the Ecclesia itself. Now, I wanted to backtrack here and again say something about my own experience. I was, from the 1970s, very, very committed to living as a Jew. I had a very clear sense from the beginning of my coming to faith in Jesus, which was in 1971, that was something I was supposed to do. Actually, my first mentor was a Jewish believer in Jesus who had come from an Orthodox Jewish background. And before there was a Messianic Jewish movement, he taught me that I was a Jew. I was to live the rest of my life as a Jew. He urged me to go back to synagogue with my father. He said, Mark, if you get married, you should marry a Jewish girl. And he told me, you should not join a church. You should simply live as part of the Jewish people. Now, I took that very, very seriously. But it was only over a number of years that I became clear in my own mind what it meant for me to live as a Jew. I knew that was something I was supposed to do. But then the question is, what does it actually mean in practice? After a number of years of study, of reflection, I concluded that one of the things it meant was living as best I could as a shomer mitzvot, an observer of the commandments, as someone who recognized the authority of the Torah in my life. And I also came to believe that in order to do that, that there was no way for me to simply come to the Bible directly and think that, for example, I could adequately observe the Passover simply by reading Exodus chapter 12 and Deuteronomy 16. You know, that in order to be a shomer mitzvot, I needed to learn from the way the Jewish people have actually kept the commandments for the last 2,000 years. Now, very, very instrumental in forming my thinking on this was study of the book of Acts. the Acts of the Apostles. I think a fair reading of the book of Acts presents us with a community of Jewish disciples of Jesus who, as it says in Acts 21, are zealous for the Torah. And I came to see that picture, which is presented in Acts, interestingly enough, is not only true of James and the Jerusalem community, but is also true for the picture that's painted of Paul in the book of Acts. I came to see that as a normative statement rather than merely a descriptive statement. There are some interpreters of the New Testament who say what Acts presents here is purely descriptive. You have to carefully distinguish between that which is merely descriptive in the New Testament and that which is prescriptive, that which is giving you actual teaching. I came to believe that was really a false way of understanding what was going on in the book of Acts. Because the question I had was not whether is this descriptive. It is what was the intentionality of the author of the book in presenting it this way. And I think one can make a very strong case that in Luke and Acts as a whole, this book is constructed in order to make a case that that this is the way Jewish disciples of Jesus are supposed to live. However, what I also saw in the book of Acts was that it was very clear that the Gentile disciples of Jesus were not were not required to observe the commandments in the same way, but they had their own set of requirements and commandments. And this, of course, is reflected most clearly in the Apostolic Council of Acts chapter 15. But what this leads to, and I developed this to a great extent in post-missionary Messianic Judaism and in my 2005 book, is a picture of an ecclesia, which is a differentiated community. It's a community that is united in the Messiah, but has two distinctive expressions of its life, of its pattern of life. This is because keeping the commandments of the Torah is something that cannot be done simply by isolated individuals. You cannot adequately live a Jewish life simply in the privacy of your own home. It requires a community to live it. What that means is you need to have a Jewish community expression for Jewish disciples of Jesus, and then the Gentile disciples of Jesus are going to have an environment which is slightly different than that. And there would be overlaps, and there would be Gentiles connected to the Jewish corporate environments and Jews who have connections and participation in these other environments. It's not this absolutely strict, rigid type of framework. But the picture I think that we see in, and at least is implicit in the book of Acts, is this twofold community of Jews and Gentiles. And so, what I then began to see was, in this picture, in the book of Acts, we have a kind of Israel ecclesiology which succeeds in not being supersessionist. It's a kind of non-supersessionist Israel ecclesiology, because what you have is a Jewish community of disciples of Jesus who are themselves living fully within the wider Jewish world. They're both living the way of life of the Jewish people. But there, it's more than that. They are participating actively in the life of the Jewish people. The picture you get in the book of Acts of the Jerusalem community is their place of worship is the temple. That's their main, they are also worshiping in their homes, but it's the temple, which is the center of Jewish life in Jerusalem and for the whole world, is also the center of their worship life. And that not just because of expediency. Now, it was expedient. Where else are you going to find a large open space where you can gather thousands of people? Where else are you also going to find a space where large numbers of Jews are gathering, and therefore where there's an opportunity also to bear a kind of public witness that the apostles were called to do? But more than that is going on. We see in Acts chapter 3, we have this description of Peter and John going up to the temple at the time of afternoon prayer. What is that? It's not actually the time of afternoon prayer. It's the time of the afternoon sacrifice, the Tamid offering, which had become also this time when Jews would gather for prayer and for worship. It's the time that corresponds today to when the Mincha service is conducted in traditional Jewish settings. It's also the time in which Cornelius is going to pray at the very same time, probably facing Jerusalem, as the Tamid offering is offered in the temple, as Jews are in the courts of the temple praying. Cornelius is offering his prayer facing Jerusalem, and that's the time when Peter and John are going up to join the rest of the Jewish people to pray with the Jewish people. Similarly, when Paul goes to the synagogue, it's not just for evangelism. That's his community. You know, in Corinth, in one of the Corinthians letters, Paul talks about being having been, you know, flogged in the synagogue, having received the lashes. Well, you know, you might say, well, that's a pretty negative description. It is, but what it shows is he's a member of that community receiving discipline within that community. If he wasn't there, he wouldn't be subject to its discipline. Being disciplined is actually a sign of participation. It's a sign that this is your community and that you are subjected to the authority of its leaders. All of this shows Jewish disciples of Jesus living a traditional Jewish life, living the way other Jews do, out of conviction, not just out of expedience, and participating in the life of the Jewish people because it is their people and it is the people of God, it is the people that Jesus himself has made a commitment to. At the same time, you have this body of Gentiles who've come to believe in the God of Israel through Jesus the Messiah, and are connected and are united with, more than connected, are united with this community of Jewish disciples of Jesus, and thereby are brought into relationship with, organic relationship with the Jewish people as a whole. And so here we have a sense of the ecclesia of Jews and Gentiles, led initially by Jewish apostles, that is organically bound up with the life and identity of the Jewish people. Here we have a kind of Israel ecclesiology in which the ecclesia experiences itself not as a replacement for Israel, but as an extension of Israel among the nations of the world. And as representing the next stage of Israel's vocation and destiny and existence through the gift of the Holy Spirit and the presence of Jesus and the teaching and life of Jesus in their midst, through the breaking of the bread, through baptism. in this context, and in relationship to Israel Christology, what I think you could say fairly is that the Jewish disciple, the community of Jewish disciples of Jesus, the apostles themselves, in the first century before 70, the Jerusalem community, but really the Jewish disciples of Jesus as a whole, including the Apostle Paul himself. What they represent is a kind of tangible, visible, concrete manifestation of Jesus in the midst of Israel, of Israel Christology, the implications of Israel Christology, that Jesus dwells in the midst of his people. They dwell in the midst of the people. The apostles of the Messiah dwell in the midst of the people. They are representing that reality. At the same time, they are representing the reality of Israel, that Israel to whom Jesus is irrevocably committed, in whom Jesus dwells, of that Israel now extended, and therefore in a sense in the very midst of the ecclesia. And so in this context, the presence of a vibrant Jewish life, of Jewish disciples of Jesus, is of tremendous importance for the very understanding of ecclesiology itself. Now, of course, this is a beautiful vision. The problem, of course, is with the next 2,000 years of Christian history. Because, of course, we know the story. The story, as we tend to tell it and focus on, is a story of the way in which the church becomes explicitly supersessionist, and also in which the way in which the church becomes explicitly anti-Jewish. And of course, that's really crucial to this story. But what's not usually told is the way in which, in some ways, the key to that move, to that supersessionist move and to the anti-Jewish move, is the active suppression of Jewish life within the ecclesia. It's not just a loss of Jewish life, because a loss would communicate something that just happens almost accidentally. You know, you just, whoops, where'd it go? You know, it was here a minute ago, and it, you know, we lost it. That's not how it worked. This was something that was actively suppressed. We read in, in the second century, in the writings of Justin Martyr, in his dialogue with Trypho, you know, and in the dialogue, Trypho, the Jewish interlocutor, asks Justin, you know, what about Jews who believe in Jesus and want to continue to live as Jews, want to continue to observe the Torah? What do you think about them? Can they do that? In your view, can they be saved? And now Justin shows in his response how broad-minded he is. He says, well, there are many in our community who think that it's really not possible. You know, who basically think that this is simply, the two things are incompatible. But I'm not among them. I think it's possible. You know? But it's very clear in the way he talks about it. He thinks it should be discouraged. He doesn't think it's necessarily a good idea, but he's a broad-minded person, and so he can live with it. You know, as long as these Jews minding, you know, are avoiding certain things that need to be avoided. Now, that view of Justin, we see how broad-minded it is as soon as we move a few centuries down the road, because what becomes normative in the life of the church is actually the restrictive view, not Justin's view. By the time we get to the 8th century, we have a church council which rules that any Jew who is baptized has to renounce any Jewish practice. By the time, of course, we get to the Middle Ages and the time of the Inquisition, we have Jews being burned at the stake because they lit Shabbat candles on a Friday night after being baptized. Now, this kind of active suppression of Jewish life in the church has quietly disappeared. These days, you won't find that kind of approach taken in most churches. It's still the case that if a Jew enters into many churches, they'll be clearly instructed that they shouldn't be doing these things, and if they do, they are coming under the law and endangering their soul. Even when that's not taught, what we still have is an environment which is inhospitable to Jewish life. You know, the church, as the ecclesia of the nations, has this long, long history, and this long history of not just losing Jewish life, but of opposing it. And while there has been in the church a taking of responsibility for a history among some for a history of supersessionism and for a history of anti-Judaism, there are you have to look very, very far to find any Christian churches that have even acknowledged that there's anything wrong with the history of suppression of Judaism internal to the life of the church. When we recognize, though, that this is not simply a moral wrong, I mean, there would be many Christians who, if you presented it clearly in this way, they would realize, yeah, there's something wrong about this suppression of Jewish life. It should have been permitted. It's wrong, and we need to take responsibility for that. But in the light of what I've been trying to present here and what's really central to my own writings, the seriousness of this is far greater. It's not just a question of a wrong being done. It is a question of an action being taken which in some sense undermines the very core reality of what the ecclesia is. In suppressing Judaism, the church, in effect, I would argue, in the implication of the words of John Paul II, suppresses Jesus. And thereby is making war with itself, with the core reality of what it is. Now, I happen to be someone who really, despite all of these things that I've just said, has a great respect for the history of the church. Now, it's the church really for this, to speak of this historical, concrete, empirical reality. I think that God has continued and Jesus has continued in the midst of the church, in the midst of its many sins and failings, and this perhaps being the chief among them. Just as I see Jesus in the midst of the Jewish people, in all of its stumblings and all of its infidelity from one generation to the next. what I see are these two traditions and two communities that both have these blind spots, this partial hardening, you know? And it has to do with that hardening, and that blind spot is how they understand one another, and how the Jewish people understands both Jesus and the church, and how the church understands Jesus and Judaism. But I think what this can do is change how Christians think about the life of the church and the life of the Jewish people. It no longer becomes a community of the saved on the one side and this community that simply needs to be saved on the other. It's two communities who both belong to the person of Jesus, who are supposed to belong to one another, and which have both, in a sense, done damage to themselves because of the way they've related to one another. Now, this session started at what time?
You have 10 minutes.
10 minutes. Okay, very, very good. Before I continue on, though, we haven't had any chance for discussion. I want to give you a chance to ask questions. I can always continue talking, but I wanted to first give a chance to see if there was anything that. Yes.
I read on the book of Israel and Christian Theology a couple of years ago.
Yes.
And the problem Kendall Solomon exposes is this paradigm of Christianity.
Yes.
The four steps, creation, fall, salvation, consummation.
Yes.
The alternative he comes with wasn't satisfying for me because I didn't find Jesus in the central.
Exactly, exactly.
So, when you talk about Jesus as the corporate Israel, I think you're doing more right to the paradigm. And I was thinking about it, and I thought, well, maybe if we can keep the central paradigm but fill in the gaps, then Israel would be done justice.
Exactly.
And Jesus would still be in the center.
Yes.
Can you maybe?
Yes, I thank you very much for the comment, because this is very much how I have seen things. I had the same. I thought that Kendall's book is like. Well, I think it's of tremendous importance. I mean, I think that it was the most important work by a Christian theologian on related to these issues. The last 30 years. But I was far more satisfied with his diagnosis of the problem than with his prescription for the solution. And the reality is Kendall himself was dissatisfied with it. His new work that he's doing on the Trinity is actually his attempt to reformulate his constructive proposal. If you read, we have the book here. Robert, could you hold up Introduction to Messianic Judaism? Introduction. The book right to your left, right there. Okay. This is a book that is a collection. It's called, it's really an excellent book called Introduction to Messianic Judaism. It's Ecclesial Context and Biblical Foundations. It's edited by a colleague of mine, David Rudolph, it includes a set of essays by Messianic, really good essays by Messianic Jewish writers presenting Messianic Judaism. But then it also includes a set of essays by some very fine Christian scholars that are dealing more with theological and biblical topics, including Richard Baucom, Marcus Bachemule, William Campbell, Doug Herink, Craig Keener, a number of others, but in particular in this case, including Kendall. And in his article in this book, Kendall acknowledges the weakness of his constructive proposal, and particularly because of this question of not doing justice to the role of Jesus, and presents what he's doing now with his work on the Trinity is as an attempt to reformulate the constructive proposal. And so what I all along was trying to do was exactly that, was trying to do something that that breaks with the way the standard canonical narrative dealt with Israel and the Jewish people, but in a way that tries to preserve the absolute centrality of Jesus in the midst of it. I think that any way of that if we truly are being faithful to the message that's been given to us of Jesus, he has to be central to it all, and he has to be as central to our understanding of the Jewish people as he is to our understanding of the church. So.
Yeah, I have a very different question on the very practical level. You said that as a believer in Jesus, you continue to be an observant
yes.
Jew. And your mentor was Orthodox?
Yeah, well, he was from an Orthodox
yeah.
background. He wasn't actually living
okay.
as an Orthodox okay. Jew, but he was very much simply living within the Jewish community.
Yeah. So how, as a Messianic yeah. Jewish community, do you make your halachic choices?
Yeah. Yes.
And maybe, you know, what if I have people in my church who find out they are Jewish
yeah.
and they want to, embody it in,
yes.
in certain ways? How can I
yes.
Help them? And
exactly.
Maybe also about, you know, the questions of ethics and halachic
yes.
reasoning, so to speak.
Well, yes. That's obviously a very broad question, and I won't be able to do justice to it. But one of the key things about the way Jewish life works is it always works in community. You know, it is fundamentally a communal paradigm of life. As I said, you really can't live as just as an individual Jew, and you have to be part of a Jewish community. And if you're developing a life, it has to be done in a communal context. So I am part of a group of Messianic Jewish leaders who share a common vision on these matters, and we've formed a rabbinical association called the Messianic Jewish Rabbinical Council. Now, in traditional Jewish life, this is like one of the basic structures of Jewish communal life. You have like three pillars of, you might say, of institutions that make up the core of Jewish religious life. Seminaries that train rabbis, congregations and congregational associations, which, while they're led by rabbis, are also fundamentally governed by lay leaders, and then rabbinical associations, in which groups of rabbis work together, particularly on halachic matters, to make decisions together as corporate governing bodies about the very kinds of questions that you are asking about, Daniel. And so, you know, that's what we were doing. We formed this group. It's maybe 20 or 25 Messianic Jewish leaders for about the last, probably for about 15 years, we have been working on these issues, because it's a massive generation or multi-generational task. You think about the vast expanse of Jewish life and of you know the all of the issues that get raised in trying to keep the various commandments, and the issues that get raised by changes by modern life itself, but then also by the needing to take into account the teaching of Yeshua, the teaching of Jesus, needing to take account of a changed status that Christians have now, that we can't just be relating to our Gentile brothers and sisters in Messiah as if they're just goyim, you know, as if they're just people totally outside of the covenant community. That we have to. So there are so many different issues, and so we have been working on that in a process for many, many years, and I feel like we're just still at the beginning of the process. If any of you want to get a glimpse of it, just go to the website of the Messianic Jewish Rabbinical Council. I think it's ourrabbis.com, something like that. And we have this document, which is like it's a work in progress. It's this continually being revised document, which both lays out the principles we're using for the interpreting of halakha and then the concrete results we've come to at this point. And I feel like they're still very provisional, and it's this work in progress that will take a generation to accomplish. But I think it's what needs to be done, and I don't know of any other Messianic Jewish group that's undertaken the task.
But you have all these distinctions between Ashkenazi and Sephardic,
yes,
and between Midnagdim and Hasidim.
Yes.
And
yes.
How do you find your way? Do you, for example, use the Kitzur Shulchan Aruch as a basic?
Yeah. Well, we use it as a source.
Okay.
I mean, it's just for all of these things, we start off with a sense of the entirety of the Jewish tradition and to a certain extent the Christian tradition as sources that we then have to work through, and then in the light of our contemporary circumstances make decisions on and rulings on. So yeah, so we take kind of the whole thing, but we don't start from the point of view of, as if this is our beginning point, we're going to be observing the Shulchan Aruch and then where do we modify it. It's more, we really, we're kind of starting not from scratch, but in a sense from scratch, but with the whole of the tradition, and saying, okay, where do we go with this, and where do we take it? And I think part of the radical thing about what we're doing is with the sense that while the scripture is the starting place, it's not. It's insufficient for determining the shape of a Jewish life. Or I shouldn't say it that way. It does dictate the shape of the Jewish life, but it's insufficient for giving us the practical way of actually expressing that shape. But then the second thing is our commitment, our sense that the Jewish tradition and the Christian tradition, in a sense, are two sides of a reality that belong together. This is the second, I would say, if Israel ecclesiology is the expression or the consequence of Israel Christology, then part of, I think, what a consequence of the kind of Israel ecclesiology that I'm talking about is an approach to these two histories and these two traditions, which recognizes the way in which they in a sense complete one another and correct one another. So that rather than using so much like the Bible to correct Jewish tradition, we can find the corrections in Christian tradition. Rather than simply using the Bible to correct Christian tradition, many of those correctives to the Christian tradition come from Jewish tradition. And it's the Bible always also being read in connection with the witness of the community the communities that have been carrying that Bible through and living that Bible through all of these centuries. So I think we should probably conclude this session.
I suggest that we have a break now. One question.
No, I have not a question. Okay. I have not a question, but hearing what you're saying, I don't know exactly the English words, but then the Holy Supper is not something new, but it's the part the Pesach, and we are connecting together, because it's not something new, it's what Jesus told us to remember him, and this may be also celebrating the Holy Supper. It reminds me of what you were saying.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. Oh. Thank you.